Three American pilots released by the North Vietnamese are en route home today. They met with newsmen in Frankfurt, Germany, and said they had been well treated by their captors. Major James Lowe of Sausalito, California, spokesman for the trio, said there had been no political indoctrination and no force or pressure had been applied. At least 18 persons were hurt in Racine, Wisconsin last night and early today in an outbreak of looting and street violence. In York, Pennsylvania, a gun battle last night in a predominantly Negro section left 11 persons injured. Again, the top story of the hour, the start of the Republican National Convention is less than 24 hours away. Most of the delegates are now on the scene. The GOP platform, completed early today, is to be made public this afternoon. Russ Ward, NBC News, at Convention Center in Miami Beach.
Listen again on the hour when Stuckey's Roadside Refreshment Centers bring you NBC Monitor News.
Has this ever happened to you? You're driving along, and then the monotony of driving gets you down. You're droopy. You've got the driving drowsiness, and that could be dangerous. Well, fight back. Pull over and take No-Doze. It's got the strongest stimulant you can buy without a prescription, and it's not habit-forming. No-Doze. No car should be without it.
The San Francisco Story, brought to you by Jenkel Davidson Optical Company, serving all of Northern California. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Bud Heide, inviting you to be the guest of Jenkel Davidson Optical Company for another half hour of the stories of San Francisco, the story-making towns and hills that surround it, and the people who made San Francisco's past so colorful. These impressions, written by Samuel Dixon, are brought to you each Sunday morning at this time by Jenkel Davidson, stylists in eyewear, with offices throughout Northern California. We hope you enjoy today's story.
If you are the age when staircases are getting steeper, shoelaces are getting shorter and harder to tie, and print in the newspapers is getting smaller, then the time has certainly come for a complete eye examination by your medical eye physician. The best plan, of course, is to have your family on a regular schedule of eye examinations, at least one every 18 months. Then, before trouble has a chance to develop, you are aware of it and can take preventive measures. An eye examination is particularly necessary after you have reached the age of 43, for then there are subtle and sudden changes which may develop with no hint that anything is happening. After the examination, if your medical eye doctor has written a prescription for new glasses or a change of lens, take that important piece of paper to Jenkel Davidson for the same exquisite care in filling as your physician exercises in his checkup. There are Jenkel Davidson offices near you everywhere in Northern California. Now to our story. Stephen J. Field landed in San Francisco in 1849 with $10 in his pocket. In 3 weeks' time, he had become the alcalde of the new town of Marysville, and in a few short years, he had attained the dignity of Judge of the Supreme Court of the United States, a position he held with honor for 34 years. Stephen J. Field was a great American, a fearless champion of what he considered right, endowed with a fearless determination that won for him many friends and as many enemies. This morning we plan to tell you briefly the story of an episode in the life of Stephen Field that pyramided in importance till it became one of the most remarkable and most sensational of the celebrated cases of San Francisco history. It involved many people, and at times it's confusing to us, and even before we commence, we are conscious of obstacles and hazards that may make our telling of it confusing to you. However, here are the characters in the drama, those who played the principal roles. There was William Sharon and Senator Broderick and Judge David S. Terry and Justice Field and a lady named Sarah Althea Hill, sometimes called the Rose of Sharon. Our first problem this morning is to know where to commence our story. Senator Broderick played his part early in the drama. This was many years before he fought the historic duel with David Terry that cost his life. Broderick was a power in the formative years of the city and a political giant, condemned by many, lauded by many. And as a figure in the political circle, he very naturally came into close and contact with Stephen Field, the most distinguished judge at that time on the California bench. Broderick was not a man of very high principles in general, but he could and did admire strength, and Field was a pillar of righteous strength. And Field was vitally interested, as Broderick was interested, in fighting to save California for the Union in the years of and preceding the War of Rebellion. The two men were drawn closer and closer together. There was even talk at times of their names being coupled as candidates for the nomination of President and Vice President of the United States. Stephen Field might have become a great chief executive, but the morals and ethics of Broderick did not commend him for a distinguished Washington career. Both men were brilliant orators, both were consummate politicians, and both were fearless in their differing courses, and they became staunch friends and champions, each of the other. And then, in a political crisis, their paths separated and they became bitter enemies. And that, finally, is the real beginning of our drama. First friendship, then enmity. And Broderick was a dangerous enemy. But before he could bring the full strength of his antagonism against Field into the open, he was to die at the hands of Judge David Terry. And by a strange dealing of the cards of fate, David Terry was to become the bitterest enemy of Stephen J. Field. But now the curtains part on the first act, and neither Field nor Broderick nor Terry appear in it. As a matter of fact, the gentleman in the star role is a little thin, dapper, rather bitter, thin-lipped gentleman, not very popular with the carefree, convivial San Francisco men about town. Not very popular with the men, but it was said that he had a way with him when it came to lovely ladies. His name was William Sharon. He had inherited, by acts of providence and shrewd business acumen, much of the properties of Senator William Ralston after the tragic death of that popular San Franciscan. He, Sharon, became the owner of the Palace Hotel and the Grand Hotel across New Montgomery Street. And he delighted to walk the glass-enclosed bridge that connected the two hotels, to stand with fists clenched close at his sides to admire his properties. Sharon's wife had died in 1875, and for 5 years he had lived the lonely life of a widower in his suite of rooms in the Palace Hotel, and then he fell in love. Fell in love with a young lady who lived across the bridge in the Grand Hotel. Not a great deal was known about her. She was young, she was attractive, she was temperamental, and her name was Sarah Althea Hill. And there was some whispered gossip about her. Unkind people even said she flirted at times with strange gentlemen. But Sharon saw her, and she saw him, and a beautiful friendship came into flower. It lasted a year. But Althea was a possessive young person, inquisitive when it came to William's business affairs, and it has been said she liked to talk and talk too much about his business affairs to some of his business competitors. To this day, old-timers still argue as to whether that was the real reason for the ending of the friendship or whether it was simply that William had grown tired of her. But whatever the reason, Althea, Sarah Althea, was told that her rooms in the Grand Hotel were needed and would she kindly move out. She refused. She pleaded with Sharon. She shrieked at Sharon, and she refused to move. So the management removed the carpets from her floors and the doors from her room. And, well, after all, a lovely young thing couldn't live in comfort under such circumstances, and Sarah Althea gave up the battle. But she felt that if for no other reason, she was entitled to compensation from Sharon, for her pride had been deeply hurt. So Sharon healed her wounded pride with $3,000 in cash and $4,500 in notes, and Sarah Althea gave him a receipt in full. But 2 years after Althea Hill had moved out of the Grand Hotel, she sued William Sharon for desertion and infidelity, demanding divorce, heavy alimony, and an equal share of his real estate holdings. She claimed that they had signed a secret marriage contract, and to prove the case, offered as testimony letters written to her by Sharon in which he addressed her as Dear Wife. There is a temptation at this point to philosophize on the folly of shrewd, wise men who put indiscreet words in letters, but we shall refrain. Sarah Althea sued, and Sharon denied all her claims and charges, and the case dragged through the courts for 5 years. And in those years, the charming young Sarah Althea became something of a vixen. People even said she was mad. She would appear in court with a revolver in her hand, and she would toy with it, aiming it at witnesses called to testify against her, and at times she would shriek out in court that everything said was lies, and she would gladly shoot the liars. And it was just about at this time that Judge Stephen J. Field entered the picture for the first time. The court examiner had been unable to control Sarah Althea, so he appealed to the circuit court, and Judge Field and his associate, Judge Sawyer, ordered that Sarah should be disarmed whenever she entered court, and that she should be kept under surveillance by an armed guard. And finally, after 5 long years, the court decided that Sarah Althea's marriage contract was a forgery. The signatures of Sharon, introduced as testimony, were forgeries. And the city papers carried sensational headlines, scandalous headlines, that delighted the headline-loving community. The only person who got no pleasure out of the decision was William Sharon, for he had died a month before it was rendered. Back to our story in a moment. You hear a lot these days about status symbols. In ancient China, eyeglasses were the symbol of prestige, and frames without lenses were often worn just to give an appearance of dignity. When you realize how ugly eyeglass frames were in those days, you can be really grateful that you were not a person seeking recognition in olden times. Nowadays, not only are the frames strikingly handsome, but modern lenses are capable of corrections that would once have been looked on as miracles. The examinations performed by medical eye physicians would cause gasps of amazement, too. How long has it been since you took advantage of the skills of your ophthalmologist? For the best eye health for your family, you should make a practice of having a complete eye examination at least every 18 months. And for precise and expert care in the filling of your eye doctor's prescription, call on the services of Jenkel Davidson, with offices near you everywhere in Northern California. Now, back to our story. Judge David S. Terry had been one of Sarah Althea's attorneys. He was a giant of a man, 6 feet 3 inches tall and weighing 250 pounds. Of course, he was no longer very young, but he was powerful and he was handsome and he was susceptible. So he fell in love with Sarah Althea, and less than 2 weeks after the decision was given declaring the marriage contract with Sharon a fraud, Sarah Althea and David Terry were married. Now, we said in the beginning that the story in its entirety is confusing to us, and we are not going to try to confuse you by following the legal activities of David and Sarah Hill Terry in detail. Terry sued to have the decision that had thrown out the original marriage contract reversed, and heirs of William Sharon brought countersuits against Terry and his wife. And year after year, there were new appeals, new suits filed, and year after year, the various scandals were revived, and the most distinguished attorneys in San Francisco were called on the various cases. Now, Sarah Althea's disposition had not improved with the passing of the years, and stories about her were legion. Judge Sawyer of the circuit court, who had incurred her wrath, traveled on the same train with the Terrys one day from Los Angeles to San Francisco. Mile after mile, while the train rattled north, Sarah Althea strode up and down the aisle, leering, scowling at Judge Sawyer. And suddenly she stopped at his seat, seized his white hair in her 2 fists, and shook him until his head rocked on his dignified shoulders. And later in the courtroom where Judge Stephen Field was presiding over the case, she denounced the witnesses, the court clerk, the court recorders, and everyone who disagreed with her. She brandished a revolver. She screamed at the judge. She even aimed the revolver at the judge until finally the marshal was ordered to take her from the courtroom. The marshal tried to do as he was ordered, but Sarah Althea slapped his face. And when the marshal seized Sarah's arm, David Terry sprang to his feet with a roar, cursed the marshal for laying a hand on his wife, and hit him in the mouth, breaking his front tooth. And then the marshal grabbed Sarah Althea's revolver and fired five of the six chambers of the gun into the ceiling. And the sound of the shots were heard outside the courtroom, and in an hour, a story was all over San Francisco that Sarah Hill Terry had shot and killed Judge Field. And the upshot of what was little more than a slapstick comedy was that David Terry, formerly Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of California, was ordered to jail by Judge Stephen J. Field, and to the jail he was accompanied by his devoted wife, Sarah Althea, both cursing Judge Field as they went, shouting to all who would listen to them in the streets that someday they would make Stephen Field pay. And to protect Judge Field, Marshal Franks appointed a bodyguard for the judge to attend him in and out of court to protect him against any attacks from the Terrys, the Mad Terrys, as they now were being called. The bodyguard was a small, wiry, fearless gentleman with a reputation as a marksman whose name was David Nagel. For 8 months, everywhere that Judge Stephen J. Field of the Supreme Court of the United States went, David Nagel was sure to be. For 8 fantastic years, the trials and counter-trials cluttered the dockets of San Francisco courts. But now we come to the last chapter of the melodrama. On August 13th in 1889, David Terry and his wife, Sarah Althea, boarded a train at Fresno, heading for San Francisco, where Terry was to make another court appearance. At 7 o'clock in the morning, the train pulled into the town of Lathrop. The Terrys entered the Depot restaurant for breakfast. And at another table, passenger on that same train, was Justice Stephen Field. Sarah Althea, gazing around the room, saw Field at his table just 20 feet away, and she whispered to her husband and then stood up and walked out of the room. Terry crossed to where Field and his bodyguard, Nagel, were seated. Judge Field was helping himself to a plate of sausages when Terry lunged, hitting him twice with his fist, first on the cheek and then on the back of his head. Nagel sprang to his feet, shouting, "Stop that! Stop that! I'm an officer!" But unheeding, Terry swiftly raised his hand to his breast and then thrust it under his coat, and Nagel leveled his six-shooter and fired. Twice. David Terry crumpled in a heap on the floor just as Sarah Althea re-entered the room. She rushed to the side of her fallen husband and crouched by his side, sobbing. But Terry was unconscious, and in a few short moments was dead. The man who had killed David Broderick in a duel so many years earlier lay stretched out now on the restaurant floor, dead. And the restaurant was turned into an uproar, for Terry's garments were examined, and it was found that he was unarmed, although Nagel insisted that he had raised his hand to draw a knife and that he, Nagel, had fired to save the life of Justice Field. The uproar became the cry of a frenzied mob, shouting that Nagel and Stephen Field be lynched, and to that cry was joined the shrieking of Althea Hill Terry, screaming for vengeance. And finally, the Lathrop constable rushed Justice Field and Nagel out of the restaurant, placing Nagel under arrest. One month later, Nagel and Justice Stephen Field were cleared of all charges. The constant threats against his life by Terry and his wife and the foul denunciations by the two Terrys were matters of record. And further, Terry had called Field a name which, according to the unwritten law of those days, justified killing. And so the case of Althea Hill, the Rose of Sharon, was closed, finally. And Justice Stephen J. Field went on to new and great honors on the bench of the Supreme Court of the United States. Yes, the case was closed. But Sarah Althea Hill Terry still fought. She developed a persecution complex. She trusted no one. Everyone was against her. She was constantly in the courts. She fought with the administrator of her husband's estate, threatened to sue him, and smashed the window of his office. As late as 1891, she appeared in the county clerk's office in San Francisco to file an appeal for a share in the estate of William Sharon. She fought with her attorneys in courtrooms, slapped their faces, and she developed a passionate interest in fortune tellers and spiritualists. But now her hair had turned gray. Her beauty was gone. There was nothing left but the need of fighting, fighting, beating down the ghosts that rose to persecute her. And they called her mad, and she was examined by physicians and scientists, and she laughed and called them mad. And then she began wandering the streets of San Francisco. She became a familiar figure on the benches in Union Square, an elderly, middle-aged woman sitting in the sun, mumbling to herself the names of William Sharon and David Terry and Stephen Field. And finally, in March of 1892, she was committed to the sanitarium at Stockton, California. And that tragic story of folly and melodrama ended just 31 years ago. Sarah Althea Hill Terry was in Stockton Sanitarium for 45 years behind locked doors. And on February 14th, 1937, there was a brief notice in the San Francisco papers that Sarah A. Terry had died in Stockton of bronchial pneumonia. The new watchword seems to be originality. Some people are trying so hard to be original that they are becoming carbon copies of those they consider their leaders. Others go quietly about the business of protecting their individuality in their own way and often end up by being trendsetters. Take the dozens of people who are daily visitors to Jenkel Davidson Optical offices. In the J.D. fitting rooms, they sit and try and reject frame shapes, styles, sizes, and colors until they come up with the ones that are exactly right for them. Skilled Jenkel Davidson fitters help by pointing out the shape that makes the most of good features plays down the bad features best. They comment on colors that emphasize your own coloring, harmonize with predominant wardrobe colors, or perk up your whole appearance. You also know that the lenses that go inside that frame are the finest that money can buy, ground carefully and conscientiously to your doctor's exact prescription. Be one of the J.D. originals and be comfortable with your better outlook on the world. You have been the guest of Jenkel Davidson Optical Company for the San Francisco story. The men and women of Jenkel Davidson hope that you have enjoyed today's program and that you will join us again next week at 9:05 when we shall tell the story of John McLaren and the building of Golden Gate Park. Many of these stories are to be found in Samuel Dixon's book, Tales of San Francisco, on sale at all bookstores. This is Bud Heide, speaking for the Jenkel Davidson Optical Company with offices throughout Northern California.
And this is KNBR, AM and FM in San Francisco. The time is 9:30.
Beautiful music on KNBR, San Francisco.
Have you tried it yet? If you haven't, you're missing the best thing to happen to beer since the bottle opener. Now, Ham smooths out the natural bitterness of the hops. A costly extra step, but worth it, because you get the smooth. A smoother taste that refreshes you like nothing else can. Ham's, the smooth, tastes so good, you'll think it's illegal.
My name is Les Williams, and this is Tony Bennett.
Be many other nights like this, and I'll be standing here with someone new. There may be other songs to sing, another fall, another spring, but there will never be another you. There will be other lips that I may kiss, but they won't thrill me like yours used to do. Yes, I may dream a million dreams, but how can they come true if there will never, ever be another you? The lips that I may kiss, but they won't thrill me like yours used to do. Yes, I may dream a million dreams, but how can they come true if there will never, ever be another you?
Yeah, that's Tony Bennett, all right, at KNBR. We're less than 10 minutes away from baseball.
The great white track drive is really getting on.
What's Pontiac doing? Giving away cars?
Just about.
Yeah, we're going to be having a doubleheader, and from Cleveland, the A's and the Indians, and the post-game show, that's after the ball game. The pregame show, which we'll be hearing, is 6 minutes from now at 20 minutes before 10 o'clock. The A's and the Indians for a doubleheader today on Sunday, and the weather picture back there is hot and muggy. And the weather picture here for the Bay Area, overcast night and morning, but sunny in the afternoons, most of the area through Monday. Tomorrow, a little temperature change.
Jack, I'm hungry. Let's go to a takeout restaurant.
Okay, but let's try doing it the English way for a change.
Oh, how's that?
Good, authentic fish and chips.
I'm not too wild about fish.
Now, Blanche, I don't mean domestic stuff. I mean the real thing. English fish and chips prepared by H. Salt Esquire.
Oh, you've got to be kidding. His name is really H. Salt Esquire?
Yep. Harry tells me H. Salt Esquire came over from Skegness, England with his family's secret recipe for fish and chips, the fun food the English love. His takeout restaurants sell the real thing.
I don't know. What kind of fish?
Icelandic fish dipped in an authentic batter, done to a delicious golden brown, served with crisp plump chips.
I'll try anything once, but I find his name hard to believe. H. Salt Esquire?
Of course. It's H. Salt, Esquire, Fish and Chips Takeout Restaurants, now in Rockridge Center on Broadway in Oakland, Park and Shop Center on Tennyson in Hayward. Here's Sue Rainey. 25 to 4:10, 5 minutes from baseball. Our day will come.
Our day will come, and we'll have everything. We'll share the joy falling in love can bring. No one can tell me that I'm too young.
Lovely Sue Rainey at KNBR, and our day will come, and the time is now 23 before 10.
This is London calling, Trafalgar Square and Hyde Park, and this is your chance to visit London this year. Enter the Schweppes Stakes now. Visit any shop that sells Schweppes Tonic or Bitter Lemon and obtain your free entry blank. Nothing to buy. First prize is an all-expense trip to London for two. You'll journey there on the BOAC Midnight Jet, a magnificent Rolls-Royce 707 that leaves San Francisco at bedtime so you can arrive in London jolly well refreshed. You'll have 5 days lodging in one of London's finest hotels, and you'll enjoy a grand tour of the city thanks to American Express. Many other smashing prizes every week. Pick up your free entry blank wherever Schweppes Tonic and Bitter Lemon are sold. Enter the Schweppes Stakes now. And good luck.
Right, dear. Thank you very much, Si. Let's pick up on a little bit of Ray Davies' trumpet group and a song called Younger Than Springtime.